The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 154.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is one of my favorite, well, definitely my favorite, oil analyst and geologist for sure. His name is Art Berman. Art, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
It's great to be back, and thanks for having me again, George. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, now what was great about our last interview we did about 5 or 6 months ago is we had the opportunity to piss off a lot of people.
Really?
And so hopefully we can get that job done today as well.
That's our objective. I'll do my best.
All right. So for my viewers who might not know what you do as a profession, can you walk them through that?
Yeah, I'm a petroleum geologist. And so my business is helping people find oil, helping people figure out why their wells didn't work and how they can be better next time. So that's most of what I do.
Yeah.
And then another part of what I do is in the analysis of oil and natural gas, energy in general, consulting with fund managers, portfolio managers who want to understand where's the price of oil and gas going, what should I have in my portfolio, and a little bit of sort of legal expert witness work. You know, people get into fights, they need somebody that supposedly is an expert. Sometimes they call me.
Okay, and how long have you been doing this?
It's scary, really. 42 years.
Yeah, I just want to set that up and frame the conversation.
So, yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, well, the bottom line is you are the guy to go to in the industry, or the guy or gal. You really, really know your stuff. So I was just listening to your recent conversation with our good buddy Eric Townsend, where you were talking about kind of the supply and demand dynamics of what you see going into the fourth quarter. And one thing I'd love for you to expand on is the difference between the price of gas or the gas usage and then diesel and jet fuel, and how that translates into what the real economy is actually doing, if it's doing well or if it's really suffering.
Sure. So nobody that I know actually consumes crude oil. I mean, we hear guys talk about it all the time, but I've never owned a barrel of crude oil in my life and don't have any intention to. I use, and you use, and all of your listeners, they use gasoline and kerosene and diesel and all the stuff that's refined from a barrel of oil. And so the largest volumetric product of oil, refined product, is gasoline. Okay, I mean, that's very straightforward. And so the problem with gasoline, using gasoline as a measure, okay, so if we're back to, let's just say, 85% of gasoline consumption compared to where we were before COVID, you know, closed our economy, then most people would say, well, you know, it's not great, but, you know, we're only 15% below where we were before, so we're doing pretty well. And the problem with that is that gasoline is something you need to play, but not to win. So in other words, if you're not selling gasoline, it sucks. But gasoline doesn't produce a lot of economic activity. I mean, when I get in my car and drive around and visit friends and, you know, spend $15 at Home Depot or something, that doesn't add a lot to the economy. Diesel, or distillate as its official name is, that's what runs the economy. That's the barometer of the economy. Trucks, ships, trains, they run on diesel. So when diesel consumption is down, there's only one reason. Nobody's placing any orders. Right. So diesel consumption is pretty insensitive to price. So, you know, when the price of gasoline was, or the price of oil was $100 a barrel, didn't make any difference at all to diesel consumption, because people were placing orders and they just passed the extra cost onto their consumers. Well, diesel consumption is down like 30%.
Okay. As of right now?
As of right now.
Okay.
And so, you know, you look at total oil consumption versus gross domestic product, and that is about as straight a line as you're ever going to find in the statistical world. Mm. And we can argue and discuss why that is, but it just is.
So diesel usage and nominal GDP?
Oil consumption, refined product consumption, and okay. GDP, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so if you believe me, and diesel is the barometer of the economy, and it's down 30%, then you can guess that economic contraction is probably some reasonable fraction of, in this case, 30%.
Right.
And so, you know, and you hear all the, well, you know, GDP might be down 4 or 5% this year, says the World Bank or the Fed or whatever. But then you read between those lines and you actually look at what, you know, a Fed chair like Kaplan is saying, and he's saying, well, you know, actually economic contraction is 24% or 25%. So, you know, which is it, man? Right. I'm not saying that GDP will be down 30%. I'm just saying that if you want to have some kind of a, you know, some sort of a good measure of where we're going, don't look at gasoline, look at diesel. Look at gasoline and it isn't great, okay? The other thing I have is that, I mean, if we're talking about recovery, I mean, recovery isn't a percent from zero to 100. Recovery is how far have we come from where we were to where we want to be. And so somebody says, well, okay, you know, we're back, or, you know, my investment manager says, well, you're only down 4% this year. Oh, okay, well, that doesn't sound too bad. You know, I'm at 96% of where I was a year ago. Well, how far down were we in March? Oh, shoot. Well, we were down 30%. Okay, so 30% down compared to where we ought to be. Let's just say it's 100%. How's that going for us? Oh, well, you're only, you know, so by that measure, you're only 80% of where you need to be instead of 96%. Oh, so we're doing better, but we're actually not doing great, right? Right. And yeah. So that's the way we need to measure all of this stuff. And people seem to have a hard time understanding that. It's like the math is too complicated for them. But that's the way I do it. And when you do it that way, what's happened by any measure is that oil consumption recovery has stalled. It went way up, and now it's just riding along flat. We're not recovering any further.
How does this compare, as far as the numbers of, with diesel usage, to 2008, the GFC?
Oh, it's much worse. Much, much worse. So if you look at, you know, any given month, even, the worst month or the worst quarter after 2008 was not nearly as bad as, you know, like the average of two or three quarters. And that's another good point, and I'm glad you brought it up, that if you graph, you know, kind of year over year consumption or quarter over quarter, and you look at 2008, 2009, it took 5 years before consumption recovered back to what it was, you know, before the crash. And so all of a sudden now we got all these talking heads who were telling us, oh yeah, you know, everything's going to be great. You know, we're going right back to normal by, you know, the end of 2020 or the middle of 2021. And you know, the question that I asked them is, do you guys pay any attention to history at all? I mean, history is not ever going to be like it was the last time, but that's probably not a bad guide. And if it took 5 years to come back after 2008, 2009, tell me why I should expect that it's going to come back any sooner or much sooner than then, when I can show you that everything about now is worse than that. Oh, well, we didn't think about that.
Based on your expertise, is there an argument for, let's say we're down 30% now, and I don't know what it was in the GFC, let's just say it was 15%, and it took us 6 years to get that 15% of demand back, let's say. So is there a case for it might even take longer to get the demand back this time because we've gone down further?
Yeah, that's certainly possible. The other way I would look at it, George, is why did we end up where we did after the great financial crisis?
Okay.
What was the problem that got us there? And what was, I mean, another way to put that is we solved the great financial crisis, which the origin of which, in my opinion, was debt. We solved it with more debt.
Right.
Okay. So what's the likelihood that Band-Aid's going to hold? Well, zero. And so the next way to think about this is how much of what's going on right now is because of a virus and how much of it is simply what was going to happen anyway and the virus accelerated.
Because of excessive debt.
Yeah, that's my view. That everything that's going on right now was inevitably going to happen more slowly over the next 5 or 10 or whatever the time range was. And COVID came in and it was an accelerant. It just, you know, made it happen super, super fast.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, and people love to say, oh, Art, you know, I agree with everything you say, because all your arguments are so logical and so data-driven. But look, the difference between you and me is that I'm an optimist and you're a pessimist. People actually tell me that. It's like, wow. Okay, so you agree with everything, but you think it's going to work out better than the data suggests that it will. And my point is, I'm not a pessimist either. I'm a scientist. You know, I have my own opinions and feelings about things. But when I talk about this stuff, I mean, believe me, I would like to be optimistic if the data allowed me to be optimistic. But my sense is that we get rid of this virus. Let's say we completely get rid of it. Let's say it's gone from planet Earth by December 31st of this year, which, of course, it won't be. I say, you know, the economy is toast for a long time to come because we still haven't solved any of the structural problems that got us into the GFC and that got us into this. And again, that's not pessimistic. That's just fact.
Yeah. So what would you say to the person who might be thinking, okay, well, I understand the argument for nominal GDP being very correlated to diesel consumption, but maybe that's just not an accurate metric anymore because the economy has changed. We're all doing business on Zoom now, and we'll continue to work out of our homes for the rest of our lives, and we're going to travel less, and we've got you know, Amazon delivering goods and services with electronic drones or something like that. And so maybe it's just a shift in the way our economy works, and we're just gradually moving off of diesel consumption. Therefore, that might not be an accurate measurement moving forward. What would you say to that, that argument, quote unquote?
I would say that the economy runs on energy. You and I and every living thing on this planet runs on energy. Okay, if you don't eat, you die. Okay, that's true for every single living thing on this planet. And the species that are the most successful are the ones that are able to get the most energy from whatever they eat and therefore have more time to sit around and do dumb stuff like Zoom or sleep if you're a lion or whatever. So it's all got to do with the productivity of the energy, in this case, that you eat and how you process it, all right? So your argument is, again, perfectly logical and reasonable. The problem with it is that Zoom doesn't run on a different form of energy. You know, working from home doesn't run on a different form of energy. We're still running off the same basis, which is oil, natural gas, coal, you know, whatever. And so we're just consuming more energy from home. We're not using less energy necessarily. We're just consuming it differently. Now, if we're able to all learn to consume a whole lot less energy, then I would say, bravo, good point. But back to the GDP curve, if we're consuming less energy, the GDP curve says we're going to be a much more slower economy. Yeah. In other words, we're going to be less productive, which means that we're going to be poorer.
That's right.
So when people tell me, oh, well, you know, fossil energy is just, you know, that's history. And in, you know, in 5 years or in 50 years or, you know, whatever the number is, we're all going to be running on renewable energy. We're all going to be running on electricity. And I say, you know what? I'm the first one to sign up for that. Now, I want to make sure that everybody who signs up with me knows what they're signing up for. Are you prepared to live in with a standard of living equivalent to, say, 1960? Now, it wasn't so bad. I was alive in 1960. You know, we didn't live in 3,500 square foot houses. We, you know, lived in 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom. People shared rooms when they were kids. You know, are you willing to go back to that? Because that's what you're signing up for. The physics of energy. You cannot get more from less. Okay, that's, you don't have to have a degree in science to understand that. Okay, so if you can get 4.5 years of human labor out of a barrel of oil, and you can get some fraction of that, call it, you know, be optimistic and say it's half. Mm-hmm. You get half that from something else. And by the way, it's a lot less for solar and wind or whatever. And again, I'm all for solar and wind. Don't mistake me. Totally for it. But you can't get more from less. So let's just be optimistic and say you get half as much from solar and wind as you do oil. Well, then there's two possibilities. Either you have to have twice as much input to get the same output, or you have to use half as much. Take your choice. I mean, it's, you know, it's there's all, you know, the equation has to balance. I mean, you don't get more from less. And so in the end, to get the same amount, you have to create the same amount of work, the same amount of heat. And I'll bet you almost anything that all the environmental problems that result from consuming oil, you're going to get them in a different way from solar and wind. And oh, by the way, how are all the metals that are used in a solar panel or a wind turbine, where do they come from? Well, they have to be mined. You know, just the simplest case is just the steel that goes into them. But what about all the rare earth metals and all that kind of junk?
And coal. People don't realize there's a lot of coal and steel.
Oh, yeah. It has to be mined. Okay. How do you mine stuff? You mine it with diesel.
Right.
You know, you got big machines that have to, okay, you get it out of the ground. Let's say the iron ore comes out of the ground in Chile. Okay. Do they manufacture a lot of steel? No. They do in China. How do you get it to China? You put it on a boat. What's a boat run on? Diesel. You send it to China. You manufacture it into casings for solar panel. How do you do that? In China, coal or natural gas, electricity. Then what do? You put it on a boat to the United States, let's say. How's it get here? Diesel on a boat. Shows up in the port of Los Angeles. Who picks it up? A truck. A truck takes it to wherever. And so there's diesel consumption, oil consumption in every single phase. Have you ever seen a wind turbine put up, installed?
Mm-mm.
Oh, well, it,
I mean,
looks,
I see,
like
them driving. They're impressive how giant they are, but I've never seen one installed or anything.
Well, you should. It's like watching a frack job on an oil well. I mean, there's hundreds of diesel powered vehicles out there that first have to level the ground and have to, you know, physically put the thing in place. And so the idea that we can somehow get off of fossil energy is like the stupidest idea I've ever heard. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not a bad idea. There's a difference, right? It's not a stupid, it's an ignorant idea. It's not a stupid idea. It's ignorant. Yeah. You can't get rid of the fundamental source of your planet's energy. You may wish you could, and maybe someday we can, but the way we're going to do it probably is by using less. That's the way we're going to do it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it just makes so much sense. You can see that person in California that really wants to feel good about themselves ordering solar panels from Tesla. And then they show up and they think, oh my gosh, I'm saving the planet. I'm just using pure, clean, green, renewable energy. And they don't think through the process that you just went through about taking it from Chile to China, back over here to the port, to you. If they actually knew how much diesel consumption went into them buying that solar panel from Tesla, they'd probably be horrified. It's cognitive dissonance. They don't want to know, because then they don't get that good feeling, which is why they buy the solar panel most likely in the first place.
And where does the electricity come from that charges the Tesla? Well, it comes, if you live in California, a lot of it comes from coal-fired plants on the Navajo Reservation in the Four Corners area of Arizona and New Mexico. I've done geological field work out there, and there's huge coal-fired plants that are just belching CO2 into the atmosphere, and it all gets sent directly to Southern California because it's close. I love California, but you know, the fact that California doesn't use their own coal to make electricity doesn't mean that their electricity doesn't come from coal.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people think electricity comes out of the wall. So,
yeah.
I hate to tell them, it just doesn't work that way. And that brings up, you know, what I think is a really important issue, which isn't purely philosophical. And that is, when in the history of any species has it ever gone from a higher productivity source of energy to a lower?
Right.
You know, has anybody found a lion that decided to become a vegetarian? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Lions get to sleep half the day because they eat high protein meat. You know, I've been to South Africa, I've been to Zimbabwe, and elephants, who are very intelligent, spend 22 hours a day eating because they eat leaves, you know, and I'm not knocking elephants, don't get me wrong, but if you eat leaves, you eat 22 hours a day.
Right.
If you eat impala, which is what a lot of the lions eat, you hunt twice a week and you sleep half the day.
Yeah.
Take your pick.
Or in other words, you have time to make goods and services and grow the economy because you're not out hunting for leaves.
Yeah. And so we think that the agricultural revolution that went on, you know, 10,000 some odd years ago was a great advance. You know, it's the right answer on a test and sixth grade or something, you know, it's right up there with, you know, with fire and the Industrial Revolution. Well, if you look into the agricultural or the Neolithic Revolution is what it's called, it actually resulted in much shorter lifespan than hunter-gatherers. It resulted in a whole lot more death because people were all crammed together. They got more communicable diseases. It was a huge decrease in quality of life and living standard. So if that's true, then why did our ancestors do it? And the answer is they did it because they didn't have a choice. Because all the big game that flourished during the ice ages was becoming extinct from climate change and from overhunting by humans. So they had to figure out another way to live. And by the way, that was a lower energy, lower productivity conversion. So they went from, you know, if you want to use that, you know, energy conversion factor of, you know, eating a buffalo, it was about, you know, you got about 10 times back what you put in. So it took you, you know, a certain number of calories to go out and hunt and kill and gut and prepare and all that. It was about 10 to 1. Well, agriculture back in the old days was about 3 to 1. Mm. So it was a substantial decrease in energy returned. And you'd say, well, why did they do that? Well, they didn't do that because it was a good idea. They did. Well, it was a good idea because it resulted in the survival of the species because right. of the, you know, yeah, the change in climate.
Yeah. And so someone would say, well, we have the same problem today with climate change. If they're, you know, if they have that line of thinking, then your argument would be, well, that's fine, but we have to do the same thing that we did back then. And that's lower and decrease our standard of living. You're trying to add an extra option in there that just doesn't currently exist. Yeah. You know, let's go back to the demand side and the supply side that we were talking about earlier, because we really got hyper focused on the demand equation when we were talking about the GFC and how the use of gasoline and more specifically diesel really went down and how that compares to today. But we didn't really get into the supply side. And most people, I think, whether they're looking at macro or energy, really get, I think, too focused on the demand side of the equation, and they totally forget about supply. They just think that if demand goes down, then prices have to go down. But they don't think about, well, if supply goes down even faster, then although demand's going down, we could see prices go up. So can you walk us through how that works with the energy space, and sure. then what we're seeing now with the supply side and what we may see in the future and how that could translate to the price of oil?
Yeah, it's a system. Okay. Energy is a system just like anything is. And so think about it like your own finances. All right. So you have an income, which is your supply, and you have an output, you know, you spend, which is your demand. And for most of us, or many of us, we also have an inventory. We have a savings account, or we have investments or something. So, you know, I've got a checking account and I need something and I write a check. And if my savings account goes to zero, doesn't necessarily mean I'm out of money. It just means I'm out of money in my checking account. I may have to go and transfer money from savings into checking, or I might have to sell some, you know, some stock or something like that. So in energy, we have supply, which is like income, and we have demand, which is like spending, and we have storage, which is like savings or investments. And those three cannot be thought of separately, just like you can't think, you know, oh my God, you know, my checking account is at $5. I'm dead. Well, you know, maybe you are if you can't earn any more money or if you don't have any savings, but if you can do one or the other or both, no, you're not $5. And so supply, demand, and storage they're all the same thing. We just, you know, put different words on them. And so, as you said, If demand goes down and supply goes down in a correlative way, what really matters is the balance. What is supply minus demand? And if the supply-demand balance is the same as it was or close to the same as it was before coronavirus, well, then I won't say it doesn't matter, but as far as is there enough in my savings account versus my spending or checking account? Yeah, we're still okay. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening, that supply has gone down almost as much as demand. And by the way, when we look at the kind of supply and demand charts that people like the EIA, the Energy Information Agency, and the International Energy Agency, and, you know, all these guys, that doesn't count storage. That counts movements out of storage, but it doesn't count movements into storage. And so that's all supply, but it doesn't count. Okay. So supply and demand is really just transactional. It's what's happening in the physical market today. It doesn't count what you have in storage. So I hear all these, you know, these talking heads every day say, oh, well, you know, the oil market is in balance or it's in deficit. No, it's not. It's only in balance or deficit if you're talking about the physical transactions that are occurring today and you don't count storage. Well, how many billions of barrels of oil are in storage? I mean, my God, there's billions and billions and billions, and that's part of supply, isn't it? Yes, it is. So, you know, so my point is the reason that energy experts exist is because why in the world would anybody else want to know all this stuff? financial people know stuff that I don't know. And so when I want to make an investment, you know, I call a guy, I say, hey, you know, is this a dumb idea or what? And he doesn't expect me to know as much as he does. I'm not saying all you guys are just ignorant. You don't know. No, you shouldn't know. But at the same time, you know, be skeptical when you hear all this stuff or read all this stuff. What if what I'm hearing is, you know, is boiled down for dummies and isn't really the true story?
Right.
And that's why, I mean, you know, you can read whatever, you know, whatever I think for free every day on Twitter or, you know, go to my website, you know, most of it's free and you can find out. But a lot of people, you know, whether it's cognitive dissonance or just mental laziness, you know, they believe whatever somebody just told them. And that's kind of the truth.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So what metrics should the average investor out there that wants to do a little homework and wants to do a good job, and they're trying to figure out the price of oil, let's say in the next year, the next 5 years, the next 10 years, what metrics should they focus on to make these decisions themselves?
If I could only use one tool, it's comparative inventory.
Okay.
All that is let's say we're working in the United States, which pretty much reflects the world market. Every week, the Energy Information Administration tells you how much oil is in storage, public information. Take that, subtract the five-year average of that data, which is, you can download the file, and that's comparative inventory. Okay. And that's the way the market works. I mean, I don't know that the market consciously works that way, but, you know, the market doesn't really give a crap about what, you know, some talking head says or what the executive director of the IEA says. The market is always doing a comparison deal. You know, the natural gas market is always looking at, wow, I mean, what's the temperature this week compared to what it was a year ago? And if it's, you know, if it's a lot higher and we have to use more air conditioning, market says, well, I guess the price of gas needs to go up. That's the way the oil market works too. And so if you do that, and it's a very simple thing to do, I mean, anybody can do it, and you just plot that stuff, what you can see is that, like any data, there's, you know, you can fit it, and, right, and you can follow a trend through it. And so right now, if you're looking at the price of oil, And when you, you know, when you fit all those points together, and by the way, it's not a perfect regression, because the price of oil has a lot of human factors involved in it. But you do this a while and you kind of get a sense of it. Price oil is about $5 too low, mm-hmm. based on comparative inventory. What's that tell me? Does that say that the market's wrong? No, it doesn't say the market's wrong at all. By definition, the market cannot be wrong. That doesn't mean the market always makes the best decisions for the planet or for human beings, but the market is what the market is. The market is trying to short everything. It's mm-hmm. trying to get the lowest price it possibly can and still maintain the supply that is needed. And so if the market thinks it can maintain supply at a cheaper price, that's what it's going to do. And so the price of oil, the price of WTI, West Texas Intermediate, is about $4 or $5 discounted right now. Because the market figures, and you know, the market is you, the market is me. I mean, the market is not an entity, but it's a pretty smart machine somehow. The market figures, well, you know, with all the uncertainties about both supply, demand, and storage and all that, I think I can have enough supply to meet our needs for $4 or $5 less. What's that say? That says that unless I'm wrong about comparative inventory, there's a $4 or $5 upside in there.
Right.
Do I know when that's going to happen? Well, actually, I can statistically, I can tell you, yeah, it's probably going to revert back to its mean, if you will. Those cycles usually last somewhere between 8 and 12 weeks. So sometime, and we've already been in this trend now for about 6 or 7. You know, we're probably halfway through a reversion back to $45 oil. Now, if you're an average consumer, you know, you don't care very much about that, although the price at the pump for gasoline may go down a little bit. But if you're an investor, I mean, hell, that's, you know, that's a 10 plus percent margin.
Oh, right.
That, you know, I mean, who wouldn't take that? I certainly would.
Yeah, so we're talking about the comparative inventory, and do you have another metric for comparative demand? And if so, do you kind of try to layer those on top of one another to get a good idea of it, just hyper-focused on the inventories?
Well, and that's the beauty of it, is that comparative inventory somehow integrates all of that. Because the only time that we put more money into savings, if you will, is when we've got enough to do it, right?
Right.
The only time we take money out of savings is when we're screwed.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so by plotting comparative inventory versus price, and price contains a gazillion psychological and other factors that I can't even begin to explain why it works. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I sort of can, but not, you know, I can't prove to you why it works, but somehow those two factors together have worked like, you know, like a charm for ever since there's been 5 years worth of data to compare to, which has, you know, been like 1995. And, you know, you mentioned that you listened to, you know, to me on Eric Townsend's podcast, Macro Voices, you know, and every time I come on there, he said, well, you know, last time you were on, you said this is what was going to happen, and damn, you nailed it. You know, I disagreed with you, and you nailed it. you know, I mean, Eric is not, you know, he's not my shill, you know. And it's not because I'm so smart. It's because some things work and some things work less well. Now, having said that, I mean, I would never use comparative inventory as my only tool.
Right.
It's a calibration tool. And you got to look at hundreds of other inputs. But comparative inventory does seem to somehow take supply and demand, and of course inventory, into account. And the price puts a whole lot of other factors in there. And combined, like I say, I mean, it's not a predictor of price, but it certainly gives you a trend. It gives you a trend idea. that, so people tell me, oh, wow, you know, price of oil is going to be $70 by March. And I say, okay, great. Here's what has to happen. You know, that X number of tens of millions of barrels of oil need to be drawn out of storage between now and then. And let's just take a look at, you know, like what maximum draws from storage have been during periods of escalating oil prices. And so I'll come back and say, okay, if that's what you think is going to happen, this is what has to happen to storage. Do you think that's likely? Oh, no, that I don't think that's likely at all. Okay, well, then there's something wrong with either your logic or my measurement, because you know, this is what historically has to happen. Well, okay, let me go back and look at that. And that's the right reaction. But the other reaction is, oh, you're an idiot and you don't know what you're talking about. And now that I guess that's why we pissed people off last time, George.
Yeah. I do it all the time. It's fine. But that's really interesting how it's just about reverse engineering kind of the data to come to a conclusion on the probability of the price being XYZ at future given date. That's really what it's all about.
Well, it really is. And that's what science is all about. I mean, it's, you know, it's not that it's easy. I mean, you have to do a lot of tedious work in any kind of science. But you know, people, I think, have a distorted idea of what science is. And in my view, science is all about describing the present state of the universe. It's about observation and description. And if I can accurately describe what's going on right now, and then I can say, well, out of all that, what are the three or four or five major factors or trends that seem to be governing much, if not most, of that present state? Well, now I've got something that I can work with. Yeah. I could be wrong about that, all right? I mean, that happens for sure. But until I've observed and described, I got nothing, absolutely nothing. And once I have, maybe I have something. And then the idea that science is a great predictor, I think is total crap. Science is only as good as the description of the present, and it's only accurate for the next moment of the present. But if I'm able to identify the key trends that control the present and assume that those will be the key trends and factors that control the future, then I can come back and do what we just did and say, well, you think the price of oil is going to be this. Here's what has to happen for that to work, unless I'm missing something, or unless, you know, there's going to be an asteroid that hits the Earth and changes everything. You know, in a reasonably business as usual model, this is what has to happen. And that's what science is. It's just saying, well, based on what I think I know about now, this is what I may know about tomorrow.
Yeah, right.
And then probably the day after tomorrow. It's a probabilistic thing. That's all it is.
How do you look at the growth of the money supply when you're trying to figure out the price of oil? I'm just trying to think through this in my head. And, you know, as we know, M2, if you look at the Fed's numbers, it's just gone parabolic. And the Fed's balance sheet base money has gone from, call it, $4 trillion over $7 trillion. So, you know, theoretically, if those deposits in the commercial banking system are increasing at an exponential rate, there's more currency units to buy that barrel of oil. But as I'm thinking through it, I don't know that makes a difference, because it's still about demand. And even if there are more currency units, if there's not more demand and if that inventory isn't decreasing, then we could have $quadrillion of M2 money supply increase, and it might not make a difference. Am I thinking about that right? Or how do you think about the growth of the money supply in relationship to price?
Well, I think about it in reverse.
Okay.
So back to, and which is not to say that what your process, I'm not saying it's wrong, but go back to first principles. If money is a claim on energy, claim on work, and that's all it is. And we talked about that last time. okay, that I want you to do some work for me. And you say, okay, it's going to cost you X amount of dollars. Okay, what we're negotiating is really your physical work. It's calories, it's joules. Okay, I'm giving you dollars in exchange for your caloric output. And so that dollar that I give you, or however many dollars we agree, it's just, it's a note. It's a claim on work. That's all it is.
Right.
Okay, so if money is a claim on energy, then debt is a lien on future energy.
Right.
It's as simple as that. And so if I go into debt, the way I have to think about that, if I just think in terms of money, if I go into debt, I'm going to say, well, do I earn enough money that I can pay that back if I divide it into, you know, say $100 a month? Do I have enough income, or do I think I'm going to have enough income to do that? And if I do, fine. And if I don't, then I'm going to have to work more, right? I'm going to have to get more work somehow. We're going to make more podcasts, or, you know, get more oil and gas clients, or drill more wells, or something like that. And if I think I can make all that work, well, that's great. And so when the central banks start printing money in great quantities as they are right now, how are they going to pay that back? Well, you say they're going to, you know, dollars. Well, but dollars are just work, and work is energy. And so it's basically a lien on future energy production. That's what it is. And so the world has been living off of a lien since about 1970. 1970 is when, you know, the U.S. oil production hit its first peak. That was when Bretton Woods went out the window and we couldn't back currency with anything anymore. And it was about 10 years later that Volcker and Reagan figured out how to get the U.S. economy moving again. How? With debt. That's how they did it. You know, and that's not a criticism. That's how they did it. You know, they increased interest rates to 18%, and every sane person in the world bought U.S. Treasury bonds. Who wouldn't? And that gave the United States all the money it needed, all the other people needed, to goose the economy and get things going again. And now, you know, we look back on those days as, wow, those were the good old days. Well, not really. They were the second incarnation of the good old days, courtesy of debt. And all that came to a screeching halt in 2008, which was, you know, the red flag saying, guys, this, you know, this is getting to be a problem. But so what we're doing right now is we're borrowing against future energy we don't have. We just don't have it. You look at world production of oil, or, you know, coal and everything else all put together, and it was flat for the longest time, you know, 2005 to 2010, and then shale gas and tight oil and all that came in. Oh, okay, now we're good. Now we got, you know, an infinite amount of oil for an infinite amount of time, except we don't, and that's now come back to haunt us. So what are we borrowing against? We're a risk. We're a bank risk. The world is a bank risk right now because we don't have that oil to produce in the future. So what's going to happen? Well, you know, now I'm going to get accused of being a horrible pessimist, but I mean, the system has to collapse one way or another. You know, I mean, somehow that debt has to go away.
You have to have a deleveraging.
We have to have a reset. Something has to happen because this cannot continue.
Yeah. So do you see that deleveraging as an inflationary deleveraging like the 70s, or a deflationary deleveraging like the 30s, or some sort of crazy IMF debt jubilee? Or how do you see that one playing out?
I think it's going to be like Mad Max, actually. You know? We're all going to be driving around in the desert fighting over cans of gasoline. I mean, right. it could be. But if anything, I see it being a deflationary process.
Yeah.
And I'm not an economist, and you know that. But I don't see everything that I see going on in my world since 2013, 2012 has been deflationary. And if oil is the principal component of energy, which is the economy, then until I see something different, that's, you know, that's my forecast for the next moment configuration of the universe is going to be a continuation of the same. And if you're printing money, I mean, by definition, you're devaluing what you already have, right? How can that be other than deflationary? I mean, you know, sure, it may, I mean, you somebody could argue, oh yeah, but you're going to have to carry, you know, wheelbarrows of money around or bitcoins or whatever to pay the bills. And we can argue about the fine points of that, but fundamentally it's a deflationary trend.
When you talk about deflationary, are you talking about just economic output or
everything? Yeah.
Because people are going to hear, you know, if we were carrying around wheelbarrows full of dollars, let's say this hyperinflation, they're going to say, well, that would mean that consumer prices, just nominal prices, have gone and skyrocketed because we need those wheelbarrows full of green pieces of paper. So I think they're going to have a hard time connecting the dots there.
No, they will, but that's because you're deflating the value of each one of those greenbacks.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Too many of them, but fundamentally, back to your comments about demand, if nobody wants what you're selling at the price you're selling it for, then you have to sell it for less. Mm-hmm. And that's deflationary. And so people in my business, they say, oh, well, you know, companies can't survive at $40 per barrel oil. Well, depends. They can't survive at $40 per barrel oil if all of the services they use are continuing to be priced at $65 oil, like drilling and, you know, all the chemicals and all the labor and all the diesel that's used to run a drilling rig. But that's not what's happening, because the service companies, they're going out of business too. And so in order to compete for what little business there is in drilling, you know, they're taking a loss. Mm. They're saying, hey, you know, I mean, we just, you know, we're bidding right now on a well we want to drill, big expensive well in Alaska, you know, and I mean, people are beating down the door because nobody else is drilling a well up there. And so we're getting, you know, really fair offers, much cheaper than we could have gotten 6 months ago,
right?
Because companies are saying, look, you know, even if I lose a little money, as long as I keep my crews and my factories and everything running, that's a whole lot better than trying to nick these guys for 10 or 15% more and then have no business at all. So that's deflationary, right? So can companies stay in business at $40 oil? Well, obviously not all of them can, but don't just assume that their costs are the same as they were before. They're all coming down. And that's what we saw after 2014, 2015. Price of oil went from, you know, more than $100 to $50. Everybody said, oh, sky is falling, everybody's going to go bankrupt. Well, no, they didn't. And they didn't because their costs went down. Correspond. Now, they don't always move in tandem. And there can be some really uncomfortable moments or months or quarters in which the service costs are still higher than the cost of oil. But eventually, you know, they somewhat align.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a mistake. I hear and read all the time about all the bankruptcies that are going to go on in the U.S. oil business. Well, you know, in 2016, there were a lot more bankruptcies than usual. But looking back on it, was it a killer? Nah, it wasn't a killer. Are we going to have more bankruptcies now than we did in 2016? I'd be lying if I said I knew, but so far, proportionally, doesn't look like it. Why? For the reason I just explained.
Yeah, so, but I know longer term, you're bullish on the price of oil. So you just laid out a great argument for being bearish a long time for the price of oil, or maybe just it being flat, they're kind of being at this equilibrium point, and that the, as of right now, lower prices aren't the cure for low prices, to use that term. But so how do we, have you changed your long-term view, or how do we get from where we are today to maybe higher prices in 3 years, 5 years?
Well, so I guess it depends on what you mean by bullish and what you mean by higher prices. So right now, $50 oil would be incredibly bullish, right? in February, $50 oil was incredibly bearish. So, you know, it all depends on what you need. No, George, my view, I just told you, I think oil is underpriced by about $5.
Right.
So right there, you know, somebody could say, oh, well, Art's bearish on oil. Well, if you like $45 oil, yeah, I guess you're right. But to my way of thinking, what's happening right now is that oil, fossil energy in general, could not be less the flavor du jour than it ever has been.
Yep.
Everybody thinks that it all sucks.
Yeah.
Now, and to read any headline, you would believe that the oil age is over, or
just the new tobacco,
or worse. Yeah, I mean it's dead, and you know, in a decade or so, I mean, we're just not going to be using the stuff. I mean, that's what the headlines say, and I'm not going to argue with public sentiment, because people feel the way they feel for a lot of complicated reasons, and I'm not good enough to do, you know, comparative public sentiment graphs. I don't know where I get the data for that kind of thing. But
right. But
back to the earlier point that we made, there will be a day of reckoning when ordinary human beings understand the trade-off, or put differently, understand the benefit that oil has provided them personally, and come to see how much of the economic growth and prosperity of the last 75 years is almost all due to conversion to petroleum. Very, very little of that is due to anything else. And, you know, and I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, you know, but I mean, realistically, the United States is a great country for one reason only, and that is we were the first advanced economy to convert 100% to oil. We won World War II because we had better access to petroleum than our enemies. So that, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, he had a commission that was their conclusion, that we won the war because Japan and Germany didn't have enough oil. And it shocked the hell out of him. I mean, he said, really? Wow. Maybe I need to read something about this. And so, you know, I think we talked about this last time. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, on his way back from Yalta, first thing he did was he met with the king of Saudi Arabia on an aircraft carrier in the Red Sea to talk about oil supply.
If you think about that, So, in other words, if we wouldn't have had more oil, we wouldn't have won World War II, we wouldn't have had Bretton Woods, the dollar wouldn't have been the world reserve currency, and we wouldn't have had this excess standard of living that we've been able to enjoy as being the issuer of the world reserve currency and consuming more than we produce.
100%. And so, you know, we like to think as Americans that, you know, it's this great American ingenuity, and we got plenty of it, you know, but I just have a real hard time believing that Americans are inherently any smarter than, you know, than Germans or French or, you know, or Chileans. Oh, well, you know, it's capitalism, you know, it's free market. Well, you know, I mean, sure. I mean, one of the things that does make us an interesting country is that we have had a lot of immigration. And so we get a lot of diverse ideas. And I think diverse ideas often lead to better ideas. And, you know, we import some of the best ideas from other countries as a result. But, you know, ingenuity only gets you so far. Capitalism, yeah, I mean, I do believe it's a better way of doing things than socialism or communism. And does that give you some advantage? Yeah, it gives you some advantage. But the big advantage the United States had was we were the first country to become a petroleum-based economy. And at the end of World War II, we had no competition. Everybody else was in the dirt. Okay, which
again, just to make sure people are following your line of thought there, go back to the lion and the elephant example, because basically we're the lion that had the high value energy. Therefore, we could spend more of our time producing goods and services and creating manufacturing and growing our economy, where everyone else was the elephant in the story, where they were just going around 22 hours a day just trying to find the next plant to eat. And they didn't have any time or as much time as we did to allocate to productive ventures.
And for 15 years, there were no other predators on the savannah because they were all licking their wounds and trying to heal themselves to get back.
Right.
And what were the events that led up to the end of Bretton Woods? Well, we rebuilt Germany and Japan, and all of a sudden they were back on the savannah. They were hunting the same impala that we were. And all of a sudden, our economy wasn't growing like it used to be. And Richard Nixon had a problem. You know, we were in the stagflation. We were having all kinds of, you know, all sorts of labor issues. And among the many things he did was, we got to get rid of this gold deal. I mean, this isn't working for us anymore. So, you know, 1970 to 1973 or four was a critical period that many people, you know, think of as a hiccup, but it was actually, you know, the proverbial canary in the coal mine. It was saying, okay, guys, you know, you got a pretty nice run off of this deal. You got 15 or almost 20 years of the savannah is yours, and there's nobody out hunting the impala but you. That's done. So figure out some new strategy to be the king of the savannah. And we figured out debt, and everybody followed us, you know, and good for them. Yeah. Now we're done with that. So back to your question is, you know, where are we going with this? And I don't see that oil is ever going to go back to something equivalent of $100 a barrel until or if we figure out a way to restructure the debt. We got to get the debt out of the way. That's the only way we're going to get back to those previous times. So on that, you know, in that way of thinking, I'm not bullish. I'm just saying that there will be a convergence of somehow realizing we've just got to take the haircut, whether willingly or unwillingly. And I don't like the unwilling way very much, but those holding the debt don't like the willing way very much. And I think we're going to come to a point where it becomes painfully obvious that replacing fossil energy with renewables results in a world that we're not willing to accept. An economy that is at best zero growth and possibly negative growth. And social unrest, like you just can't even imagine. I mean, you know, if we, the only reason that we have 7.5 billion people on the planet is because of fertilizer. And the bat guano ran out a long time ago, or whatever the guano comes from in South America. And so the only reason we can support 7.5 billion people is because a fertilizer that is 100% reliant on fossil energy. I mean, the process that Haber and Bosch developed in 1909, which allows liquefaction of air to produce ammonia, requires incredible amounts of heat. Where's the heat come from? Solar panels? Uh-uh. it comes from natural gas.
Right.
And so if our standard of living, our world standard drops by, you know, even 10 or 20%, much less 50%, and people are going to starve. Billions of people are going to starve and die. And that is, you know, it's not just sad. I mean, it is sad, but the social, the civil unrest that will result from that, you know, we just can't even imagine, much less tolerate. And so I think there's a day of reckoning in which by trauma, the experience of trauma, you know, it's just like in Eastern Europe. I mean, they've been a couple of years done with communism and things were sucky. And, you know, bring us back our communists, you know, we like that better. Well, okay. So we, you know, we put a different suit on the communists and called them, you know, social democrats or whatever, and now they're running the show again. And yeah, Putin's a KGB guy. You know, I'm not criticizing Putin, but people want to go back to what worked better. And I, again, I'm all for renewable energy, 100% for it, but it just can't carry the load. It cannot carry the load by itself.
So in order for us to get back up to, let's say, $80+ oil, we the catalyst we need to be looking for is a mind shift with the societal narrative, or maybe the political narrative, that's like, you know what, we don't want to decrease our standard of living, so this is what we've got. We're just going to have to figure out how to utilize this better, or something to that effect. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
It's 100% what I'm saying. It's a phase change.
Got it.
Okay. I mean, you know, we got ice, and we change the temperature and pressure, and it becomes water. Same molecules. Okay. Everybody's in a bad mood, and George, who's a happy guy, walks into the room and says a few things, and all of a sudden everything lightens up. That's a phase change. You know, yeah. I'm thinking one way, and somebody says, well, what about? And all of a sudden I change my mind. I start thinking differently. That's a phase change. Yeah. Okay, we're in a phase change right now that says we don't need oil, coal, and natural gas. Fine. Okay. As long as that is our phase, as long as that is our mood and our sentiment, then things are going to develop in a certain way until they don't anymore. Yeah. And then, you know, we either fight with each other or we change our mind. We have another phase change.
Yeah, got it. Got it. So I know we're running short on time, Art. I appreciate you hanging out this long. I just want to kind of get your idea as to what's going on with, like, the World Economic Forum. I don't know if you've followed this at all, but they're really pushing this agenda towards green energy. And again, we're not saying that's good or bad or anything, but I do try to figure out what their motivation is. And is it something to where there's, you know, it's hard not to go down the path and say, well, I mean, if they truly are the smartest in the room, and I doubt they are, but let's just assume that they have all this information, they talk with all the global elites and the hedge fund managers and the really, really smart people that know this stuff, you've got to assume that they know what you're talking about. And they know how detrimental it would be to try to go from petroleum to, let's call it, quote unquote, green energy over a 6-month period. So if they know this, but they're still pushing for it, then the only conclusion you can come to is that there's some sort of malicious intent where they want the standard of living to go down. Or should we give them the benefit of the doubt and say, you know what, they're altruistic, they want what's best for society, but they're just ignorant and they really don't get what they really don't understand the ramifications of what they're trying to achieve.
They're energy morons.
Okay.
That's all I need to say.
Okay.
You know, human beings have less attention span than a goldfish. And energy is complex.
Yeah.
Okay. And politicians, I've never met a politician, and I've met plenty and tried to have these discussions with them. I've never met a politician who doesn't glaze over and say, I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about, Art, but you got to package it differently because I can't get elected on that.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Wow.
I've walked the halls of the Congress. I've spoken with all these guys, and, you know, some of them kind of vaguely get what I'm talking about. But, you know, I mean, you've got a lot more patience than they do, and your listeners have a lot more patience because they're actually interested in knowing something they can use. These guys, and I'm not saying they're bad people. Some of them certainly are, but not all of them. The one piece of information they can use is how do I hang on to this job? How do I raise enough money to get reelected? Because that is their job.
Right.
And we've made it that way. Yeah. And they don't have time for this crap. They don't have time for something as complicated. Give me a talking point, man.
Yeah. They don't have time for reality. They're too busy buying
point
votes.
Is green jobs are going to create a whole bunch of green energies can create a whole bunch of jobs, and that's good. Oh, okay. Got it. I can sell that.
Right.
But the details, no, you know, so you're going to take jobs that are currently in oil and gas, and you're going to teach those people how to, you know, run wind turbines and monitor solar panels. So you're not creating any jobs, probably. You're just taking people who are out of work and teaching them how to do something new. I mean, I just saw an article, and I think it was Financial Times or can't remember, just this week, that said that, you know, the average green energy job in the United States is something like $49,000 a year. Mm. Well, I'm not signing up for that. I'm not turning down my nose at it. I'm just saying that's not attractive to me. You know, I can get $49,000 a year teaching elementary school.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know, and I'm glad there are good elementary school teachers, but that's just not some, that's not a job category that I'm going to go after. And I don't think a lot of people watching this podcast are either. And so, you know, that's just information. That's just data. So I think, so the answer is these guys, they're politicians.
Right.
And they're figuring out, they're measuring the, you know, taking, there's which way's the wind blowing. Okay, it's blowing green. Give me a few talking points so that I can sell green, and don't bring anybody into this room that says anything that pops that bubble.
Yeah. We need to, you have, whether you're on the left or right, it just doesn't matter. You have to realize that what these politicians are telling you is not what they believe in. They don't have a belief system. They have no moral North Star whatsoever. They have no integrity. The only thing they're telling you is what they think you need to hear in order to vote for them. Period. That's what we have to understand going into not just this election, but any election, really.
And we allow it to be that way. I mean, right. You know, every country deserves the government that it gets. Right. Whether that's a repressive, autocratic government or whatever. I mean, we, on some level, we enable that.
That's right.
So, you know, all the CEOs of oil companies that everybody criticizes now, they praised them a year and a half ago. You know, I find myself defending them. I say, wait a minute, you know, all these shale guys, they were just telling you what you wanted to hear. You loved them then, you hate them now. You know, I was cautioning you then, and now I'm defending them. How crazy is this? They're just doing what they were appointed to do, which is to raise the stock price of their company. That's what their job description is. They were doing their job. These elected officials, what's their payback? Getting reelected, having that influence for another 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, whatever. So, you know, it's... Yeah.
Their motivation isn't the health of the globe or the climate.
No.
Their motivation is just more power. And that's just the bottom line. Whether they're on the left or right, it doesn't matter.
And I hope people understand. I mean, you know, what we're talking about here is completely apolitical.
Yeah.
I mean, I can criticize the right, the left, and the center equally. Or praise them on all of these subjects. But I told you that they're all energy morons, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I don't expect them to do, you know, nobody calls me and says, well, Art, you know, how should I vote on, you know, Senate bill, whatever. And I'm not suggesting that they should. I'm just saying that I know something about this little piece of the world, and they don't. And you should know that.
All right. Well, Art, for any of my viewers who want to find out more about your piece of the world and what you do, where can they go to check that out?
ArtBerman.com or at AEBerman12 on Twitter. And that'll take you to wherever you need to know. And most of my website's free. There are some paid subscription services if you want more detailed analysis, but all you got to do is give me your email address to get in, and most of it's free.
Awesome. Art, thanks again for your time. I can't wait to do it again.
Thanks, George. Always enjoy talking to you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.